welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner. This is Sam Minter. It's Wednesday, January 6th, 2010. I'm doing this a couple days later than usual, and I'm doing it without Yvonne. He had something going on at our normal time, and then I was going to record a solo, but then I had other stuff going on, so I'm a couple days late. I'm sorry. I'll try to probably get the thing out around the same time I usually do. Anyway, this will be a short show, as it usually is when I do solo shows. But a couple quick things to talk about. Nothing big, nothing too momentous, I guess. I don't know, this has been... We talked about it last week, and I just want to talk a little bit more about the whole thing with overreacting on security measures and things like that in terms of the attempted Christmas bombing of a plane flight. But I don't want to restrict it just to that. I think this is just a symptom of how, in general, and this point's been made time and time out again, human beings are really, really awful at gauging risk and acting appropriately based on that risk. I've made the analogy a number of times of an allergic reaction, and I really think that's very similar to what happens in all these situations. There is something that happens and it scares people because it's unusual and outside of their normal expectations, and they get scared and they try to react to it, and because you got to do something, and you end up with the reaction ending up being much, much worse than the initial thing that you're worried about. And I think the whole thing with airline security is an example of that. But I'd say this whole damn war on terror idea, that even if Obama's not using those words anymore, the whole thing is just falls directly into that category. Because fundamentally, if you imagine the worst possible scenario you could imagine, well, maybe not the worst possible scenario, but yeah, let's take what, I used the example a couple weeks ago. Let's say, you know, you blow up an airliner every month, you know, and what's that? If it's a big one, 300-400 people. In all of this back and forth that's been going on about this, one of the stats that's come that, you know, people have pointed out a couple times is in the United States alone, 46,000 people a year die in car accidents. Now that's actually a little bit larger number than I thought, and I should probably, you know, check it. You know, because I'm pulling that number out of my ass because I think I heard it. But, you know, here we type, how many people die in car... There we go, car accidents. About 40,000 a year. Okay, so I'm in the right ballpark. Anyway, how many planes have to blow up to get 40,000 a year? You know, and again, you know, let's do the division here. 40,000 divided by, let's say, 300 people on a plane. 133 planes a year would have to crash to be equivalent to the number of people who die in car crashes. But do we see all kinds of crazy things going on? Do we say, you know, we want to prohibit people from driving because they're going to kill? No, because it's part of our normal experience. I mean, you know, as Yvonne pointed out the other day, you know, a friend of his had their father die recently in a car crash, and it's tragic, and but it happens, and everybody sort of is aware, oh yeah, car crashes happen. And if it happens to you or someone you know closely, it of course affects you greatly. But you don't find people, at least not very often, arguing that we should turn upside down, you know, our entire system of transportation just to avoid these car crashes. But yet you see a much, much smaller number of people affected by, you know, people blowing up planes and stuff. But yet we're willing to turn completely upside down, you know, the procedures we use here, and add tons and tons of inconvenience to everybody who has anything to do with any travel, and give up all sorts of our own personal freedoms and civil liberties in order to defend against this stuff. It's a tiny problem. Now, you know, okay, so, you know, maybe, you know, blow up 10 planes a month and you're getting close to car crashes. There are, of course, things that kill more people than car crashes, too, and diseases and such. Heart disease, cancer, things like that. I think those numbers would be higher, and I should check that, too. How many people die from cancer anyway each year? You know, Google's fun. 565,000 a year, approximately. Yeah, so the rational approach to these kinds of things is to make sure the response is proportional to the problem. Or at least, you know, let's give some benefit of the doubt. Let's, the perceived possible problem, reasonably possible problem. So, okay, maybe terrorism only killed, you know, if you count 9/11 and everything else in the U.S., a few thousand people over the course of a decade. But let's say, you know, you want to anticipate what it could do if you didn't do all of these reactions, you know, and okay, let's say it's 10 times that much. Let's say it's 100 times that much. It's still tiny compared to all kinds of other things that cause people harm. Now, okay, maybe you want to do a, okay, worst case scenario. You know, Al-Qaeda gets, you know, a nuclear arsenal comparable to the size the Russians had during the middle of the Cold War, or I guess still have, and decide to blow up all of the major U.S. cities. Okay, maybe you're getting a decent-sized threat at that point. But does anybody really think that size threat really exists at this point, or would reasonably exist anytime soon? I think the worst-case scenario anybody has actually outlined is maybe some terrorist group gets a hold of one low-power nuke and blows it up in a major American city. That would be pretty bad. That would be pretty bad. But even there, as bad as that would be, if you measure it against other commonplace threats that happen all the time, it's probably still not as big as the reaction has been warranted. Now, I know this sounds sort of, you know, what do you mean? You know, they blow up an American city and we shouldn't care? Well, no, I'm not saying that at all. Not at all. It's, and it all depends on the strength of a weapon, blah, blah, blah. The estimates I've heard, if they had a really small one, are that it wouldn't actually come anywhere close to, I mean, basically a small nuke is the same as a fairly large conventional weapon. And so there are all kinds of effects, and I don't want to minimize. I don't want to minimize. That would be bad. That would be pretty bad. But take that aside, and all of these other things that people are worried about, you know, from, you know, car bombs here or there, blowing up a plane every once in a while, you know, really, is it worth turning everything upside down? No. No, 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 no. You know, let's try to actually have some semblance of removing the emotion from it and doing, you know, a rational analysis of various threats that are out there. You know, some rogue terrorist group killing a few thousand people every once in a while, and so far the, you know, the biggest event was in 9/11, and it's a few thousand over the course, you know, and one time in a decade, and hasn't recurred since. But let's say they did that every year. Even if you had that every year, it's still a tiny number compared to, you know, all of these things. Cancer, heart disease, car crashes. I'm sure you could list dozens of other things that kill more people every year, that directly affect more people every year. If we were at all rational about it, you know, those things would get proportionally more. You know, something that kills 1,000 times more people over the course of the last decade than terrorism should be getting 1,000 times more attention and resources thrown at it to address that issue. But that's not the way we've been operating. And that's crazy. You know, over the last week, there have been people out there criticizing Obama and saying, you know, he doesn't believe there's a war. He doesn't believe we're at war. And of course, his administration has reacted and said, yeah, the president has said we're at war. He realizes we're at war. No! We're not. Yeah, from a technical legal perspective, there hasn't been a declared war in the United States since World War II, which I guess officially didn't end until 1989, whatever. But even if you forget the technical legal definition and talk about when we are really have been at a state of, in a state of war, you know, okay, Vietnam, Korea, you know, Iraq even, and we're not at war in Iraq or Afghanistan right now, because in both cases, we accomplished the goal of the war, we changed the administration there, changed the regime there a long time ago, and we are now there with the support of the current governments in both of those locations, which means we are not at war there, we are, you know, doing something else, and there is combat, but it's not a war. But anyway, whatever. The war on terror or whatnot, if anything, has more in resemblance with the war on drugs than anything else, which is another bad term and something which is stupid anyway. But I think, you know, people have been saying, oh, he's not treating it seriously. He's treating it as if it's a law enforcement matter. Well, damn right. That's what it should be. Somebody tries to blow up a plane. That's attempted murder. I don't care why he tried to do it. That's what it is. That's how we should treat it. It's not some sort of existential threat to the country. Not even close. Even if he succeeds, even if they do it all the time, the only way it can become an existential threat is if we react to it by doing insanely stupid things, by throwing all sorts of restrictions on immigration to keep smart people out of the country who could help our economy, by making travel to and from this country so onerous that people don't want to do it, by killing the airline industry and the notion of cheap and easy travel, by making travel painful by compromising our own core principles, by not living out the notions that, you know, to quote the, you know, all men are created equal and are deserving of basic human rights like due process and trial and the right to be defended by a lawyer and to confront their accuser and all this stuff. And I'm not talking law or anything like that at this point. I'm talking about basic principles of fairness and human rights. And for that matter, you know, freedom against surveillance of various sorts without, you know, proper cause, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, process. You know, throwing people in jail with no charges and no indefinite detention. All of these things, these are what makes it an existential threat. Not the acts themselves, not blowing up a few planes. It's people reacting and overreacting due to fear and doing things that fundamentally change the core values of the society and or produce an economic drag that hurts everybody. I mean, there have probably been more people killed in the last decade because they decided to take a car instead of the plane and crashed their car than have been killed by terrorist acts in the United States in the last decade. Or for that matter, you know, people who had, I don't know. I don't want to make stuff up. But the unintended consequences here, I think, far, far outweigh any benefit that comes out of any of this nonsense. And it's so frustrating because it seems so irrational when you step back and look at, okay, let's actually look at what is the magnitude of the problem that we are trying to solve and compare that to the magnitude of the solutions we are imposing, the quote-unquote solutions we are imposing, and the effects those have, which maybe, slightly, or forget slightly, let's give it the benefit of the doubt. Let's say all the enhanced security measures over the last decade really did prevent, you know, a rate of terrorist attacks that would have been 10 times higher than what we actually saw. Even then, is it worth it? And people get very nervous when, you know, oh, you're comparing, you know, you're trying to put a value on a life, and how does you know, the fact that 10 less people died compare to millions of people being inconvenienced in various ways? And how do you do that analysis? Well, you have to do that analysis. You have to look at that kind of thing. Anyway, very frustrating. I've talked a long time. So we're going to take a break for our poem of the week. And I will be back in a few moments with a few thoughts on something completely different. We'll be right back.
This is the Curmudgeon's Corner Poem of the Week, brought to you by Notel Motel.
Souvenir by Carly Sachs. That afternoon, which one? Was it Cleveland? You held them all, careful as you are with eggs. You're getting older, but in the snow globe of your heart, it's always Tuesday. There's the cottage you will never enter, the sword you will never draw. What honeymoon is this on your dresser? Plastic desire, promise of change. Every time you shake it, go back to that highway rest stop or souvenir shop, memory's darling. Yes, you had to have it, the glitter settling like ash. Go ahead, Just try and break it open.
For more like this, go to notelmotel.org with a new poet each week and a new poem every weekday.
Okay, now we're back. You know, I realized as we went into that break that I pretty much talked for 19 minutes straight. And, you know, wow. You know, who knew? Who knew I could even do that? Anyway, enough of all the terrorism and risk analysis and security, and I'm really... Anyway, I'm really not saying that there should be no security or anything like that. Just that we should be somewhat rational about this stuff and proportionate and not, like, overreact to the scary things. Even though they are scary. They are scary. They're unusual, but that doesn't mean they're more important than the usual everyday risks. They're just more unusual. Anyway, I promise something else. So let me not go on about that anymore. This next thing actually isn't so much, you know, me ranting or talking about an opinion on anything particular. It's more, you know, I know there are a few of you out here who will have an opinion on this. So I am asking for advice. So send me an email at abelsmay@abelsmay.com or comment on my blog when I post this podcast. But here's the deal. It was very likely, we've been on a cycle of replacing computers every 3 years or so in this household since there were three of us. My year to replace my aging iMac was last year, 2009. But we kind of decided to have a baby instead. And so the new computer got pushed off a year for me. But at this point, it seems very likely that sometime within the next few weeks, I may be getting a nice new, probably an iMac. Okay. You know, there have been some question, do I want a Mac Pro or something like that? But I think I'm probably going for an iMac again. There's also the question of, do I want like a laptop again? Because previous to this iMac, I'd had a laptop, and I had said at some point, I'm never going back. You know, there's no reason to have a desktop anymore. But I think where I am right now is I have a laptop for work. So for most of the situations where, you know, I need a laptop, I have use of that one. So, you know, if I'm at home and, you know, want to surf the web on the couch upstairs instead of down in my home office, I can use my iPhone. I can use the work laptop. There are options there. And so it makes sense to also have a desktop. So long as I have a work laptop. If I did not have a work laptop, then I would probably be thinking more seriously of a laptop for myself for home. But as it is, you know, I'm thinking nice, big, huge screen, huge internal drive, lots and lots of memory, all of that kind of stuff. You know, basically a maxed out iMac, because, you know, with my current machine, I am constantly maxing out both the CPU and the memory. So just to give you an idea, let's see, right now, the machine I have has 2 gigabytes of internal memory. Right now I have free about 300 megabytes, and that's actually low. Usually I'm completely full. I quit a whole bunch of things so that I would only be running a fairly small inventory of things while I was recording this podcast, and CPU is completely maxed out. Yeah. Anyway, and it's an iMac that will be almost exactly 4 years old in a few weeks. So that in in February, it'll be exactly four years old. So you can go back and look up the specs. I'm not going to bother. Anyway, the point is, I am constantly with this machine at this point, feeling how slow it is, feeling its limitations. I am utilizing it to its fullest extent and some. But here's the thing. I don't know how much of it is slow because it really needs to be, and how much of it is slow because the accumulated cruft of many years of crap that I have built up on this thing. You know, when I upgraded to Snow Leopard, there were a few incompatibilities that forced me to go through and look for some things, and I found, you know, like, there were incompatible drivers for a trackball that I had not owned for several computers back in the past, like 6 or 7 years back, or maybe not quite that far, but a long time. And there's nonsense like that that's slowing things down. Now, there's also all kinds of stuff that I have the system doing intentionally. You know, I have it checking and logging all kinds of stats. I have a webcam running on it that's continuously taking and storing pictures. So, like, you know, and because I'm an idiot, I have the webcam always generating time lapses as well, so that, you know, every day I'm generating a new time lapse of the previous day, and I keep them forever, so I use up disk space like crazy. But it's also constantly saving pictures, and, you know, I've got other things that go and check the web and grab some stats and make graphs, and, you know, I have timed activities that several times a day go and to the hosts. I have my wiki on, my blog on, all this kind of stuff, and back everything up back to my machine. I've got, online backup to Backblaze going the opposite direction from my computer to the cloud. I've got Time Machine going, doing backups. I've got, I've got all kinds of crazy nonsense going on, which leads to the primary question. When I get the new machine, every other time I've gotten a new machine, going back at least a long, long time, as long as Apple offered the feature to migrate automatically from an old machine, I have done that. And I've always done upgrades when I've done major operating system upgrades, 10.0, going back to system 9 for that matter, you know, 9 to 10 to 10.1 to 10.2.10. I have not done a completely, totally clean factory install probably in a decade, maybe even longer. I don't know. I think probably every single, I don't know that I've ever done a clean install since I've had Macintoshes, which would have been right after I graduated from college. So we're actually talking, gulp, close to 20 years. And I must have done a clean install somewhere along that lines, but I'm struggling to remember it. I think I've done various forms of upgrades along the way. You know, probably the early part of that time, automatic migration probably wasn't there, so I had to do things manually. But yeah, here's the fundamental question. When I get the new computer, should I do a migration just like I've always had? Or should I say, you know, let's start fresh, let's start clean, and I'm not talking about data files. I'm going to bring over all my music. I'm going to bring over all my pictures. I'm going to bring over the many, many gigabytes of accumulated files that I've had over the years. But I'm talking about system stuff and application stuff and all of that kind of stuff. Do I start completely clean? And then reinstall things only when I find that I need them? I mean, frankly, a lot of the automated stuff I was talking about, webcam and all that crap, I could keep that on the old computer and not put it on the new one at all. Even the backups and stuff I was talking about for my blog and stuff, I could just keep all that on the old computer. And that seems very tempting. But on the other hand, I'm like, oh, do I really want to get into a situation where, you know, the old computer is doing these things, the new computer is doing these things, and some of my stuff is here and some of my stuff is there. And then at some point I'm going to be like, oh, I want it all here in one place after all. And then I'm going to have to set everything up again, and I'm going to, and it's just going to take a whole lot of effort, and you know, I'll undoubtedly miss something, and then I'll regret that I missed it, or because, you know, I'll fail to set something up and I won't realize that I failed to set it up until it becomes a problem later and I can't undo it. I don't know. So I've been going back and forth on this for the last few weeks when I've been thinking, oh, you know, it actually is probably fairly imminent that I'm getting a new computer. And I don't know. I'm on the one hand, I'm really tempted by the notion of a clean, crisp, straight out of the box with all of the defaults exactly as they come from the factory and start from there and then only modify the things that I really need to modify. I'm guessing I'd have a really nice experience there for at least a while. But on the other hand, I'm like, you know I'm going to screw something up. I mean, moving my iTunes library is going to be a pain. Or maybe it's just copy the directory and everything's happy, probably. Or, you know, maybe it's, you know, I'm going to screw something up. I'm going to forget something. Also, if I keep anything on the old machine, it also prevents repurposing it. So, like, because I'm still going to have it in active use for something or other. Whereas, potentially, if I did migrate everything, I could wipe the old machine and set it up with a clean, fresh Snow Leopard install and then go put it in another room or something and set it up as, you know, with just a guest account or something for logging in and web surfing, or I don't know. I'm sure I could figure out something useful to do with it. Whereas if I keep it doing some of my core functionality, then I'm going to want to keep it in my office too. I'm going to want to keep all of its stuff exactly how it is, which will keep all of its old problems. I don't know. If I do the clean install, move the data files, that's critical. Like, you know, you can always recreate configurations to do automated backups and all that crap, but it's the data files that have to come no matter what. You know, if I do that, maybe after a few weeks I'll realize I can just wipe the old one after all, because I'm not really using any of the stuff on it. Anyway, I just wanted people's thoughts on clean installs. I know a lot of people recommend not only doing it when you get a new computer like this, but also anytime you do a major system upgrade, just doing a complete fresh clean install and then restoring your data files from your backup or whatever. I'd be interested in your thoughts on my dilemma. Like I said, I've been going back and forth. At this very moment, if you asked me, I'm leaning towards the let's get the thing out of the box and have it nice and pristine and move my data files over, but then only do any other customization when I find I need it. I can't even remember all the customizations I've made to this stupid thing. I think I've changed the default shell. I've added, I've used things like TinkerTool to change how the Finder shows files so that it shows hidden files and so that it does, you know, I don't even know all the stupid options that, you know, things like TinkerTool let you do, but which are also things you can do on the command line to change little tiny things about how the operating system does this, that, or the other. And I've tweaked, you know, dozens and dozens of things over the years. I don't even know which things are things I've tweaked and which things really are how it is. I have no idea. But all I know is my current computer is really slow, crashes a lot, does weird things, and it'd be interesting to see how much better a clean one is. Of course, I'm not going to be able to distinguish that between, you know, having most likely 8 times as much memory as I have, you know, a CPU with a much higher clock speed and a couple generations down the line in chips, you know, nice big screen. Hard drive, I think, is only going to be twice as big, I think. I don't know. That hasn't gone up as much as other things. Anyway, I don't know. What do you guys think? I'd be very interested in your opinions on that. I've got a few weeks before anything real happens on here, but let me know your thoughts. And we're pretty much going to wrap it up. A couple quick notes, I guess. CES is coming up. There'll be some gadgets. Maybe something worth talking about. I don't think we'll talk about, but their Democratic Party has been talking about how they're going to change superdelegates for the next presidential election. Yeah, whatever. It's probably not even going to matter next time around, but it'll eventually matter. The Google phone, the Nexus One, was officially announced earlier this week. I'll be honest, I haven't even dug into the details, but it seems fairly unimpressive and definitely not a game changer. Maybe it's laying the foundation for some things for the future, but I'm not really all that excited with what I've seen so far. It's probably a cool phone, but doesn't tempt me at all, not from the perspective of someone who already has an iPhone. I mean, I wouldn't change for it. Maybe if I didn't have anything, it would be worth thinking about, but I don't think I'd go beyond thinking about it. I think I'd still get an iPhone. Although there are some interesting things there, I guess, or whatever. More rumors about the Apple tablet. We'll know in a few weeks. Whatever. Time. I just wanted to mention, you know, I don't have enough. Over the last year, the tendency has been less and less time that I have to just sit down at my desk and do the various things I want to get done for home. I mean, obviously there's work, but at home there's, you know, Amy's got activities several nights a week that take time. I've got things to do with Brandy. I've got things to do there. And of course, we've got Alex taking up lots and lots of time too. And I don't regret any of that time for any of those things. I love doing those things. But at the same time, I look around in my office and see piles and piles of paper that are just building up and never going down of things that I want to look at, things that I want to do, things that I want to track, projects that I want to experiment with or do things. And who the hell knows when I'll do any of it. And I think I'm getting very close to the point of mental adjustment where I have to just say, you know, that's not going to happen. Let's stop even pretending that it's going to happen. Let's stop thinking, you know, I'm going to carve out a few hours a week to work on that pile and drive it down. Let's not even pretend. I'm not quite there yet, but it's getting so much closer because, you know, there's so much I want to do. But realistically, when I prioritize the various things I could be spending time on, they lose. And it makes me sad that I'm not going to get them done, but at the same time, they lose. You know, spend time with my daughter and son, or go through a pile of bills and put them in Quicken. Guess what? One of those loses. You know, and even other projects that would be more fun for me, still, they lose. Maybe someday. I keep saying, you know, when Brandy asks about some of this stuff, and why do I even try? I'm like, you know, one day I'm going to retire. And then I'll finally get to that stuff. Of course, you know, I still think about that related to some of the projects that I was working on when I was 12 years old that I worked on a lot as a teenager and then sort of fell behind on and didn't get back to after I went to college. Every once in a while, I still think about some of those. And I'm like, I'm going to get back to that. You know, that project of cataloging all the scores that were ever made on any video game I had on my Commodore 64 or VIC 20? I'm going to get back to that and make sure those get properly entered from the pieces of paper I have in a box somewhere in storage into a nice proper database. Yeah, I still think about that. Or that project I did to, you know, redefine the world's country boundaries based on distances from capital cities and, you know, draw little maps with where those boundaries would be. Yeah, I'll get back to that. Or, you know, the Abels may function. I'll get back to that or whatever. Yeah, maybe not. I mean, the current examples are, you know, putting a lot of financial information into Quicken. I'm like 3 years behind at this point, and I want to have nice little graphs of my net worth and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, not happening. I was doing a lot of genealogy stuff a few years ago. Yeah. Haven't gotten to much of that in the last couple of years. There's some math stuff I'd like to do. There's some stuff with the website I'd like to do. Yeah. Kind of sad. Not happening. But there are better things going on at the same time. You know? Yeah, I could do that. Or I could spend an hour playing with the baby. Yeah. The baby wins. And I think that's it. Oh, one final note. The last two shows, I've been using a new microphone I got for Christmas. Hope you guys like it. It sounds good, etc. I think it sounds okay. You hear a little bit more background noise. Maybe I should put some gating on that. But, you know, whatever. But I think the voice sounds better. Maybe. I don't know. Of course, when I'm talking to Yvonne, it also goes through Skype. So, you don't care. Show's over. Goodbye. Thank you all. As usual, email me at abelsmay@abelsmay.com or comment on abelsmay.com for the post where I announce the new episode. We like to hear those comments. We will respond either online on the website or on the next show. And yeah, tell all your friends how much you like the show and that they really, really, really should listen. Okay. I keep saying I'm done, but now I mean it. Talk to you all next week. Yvonne will probably be with me again. Goodbye.